So I want to go into more detail about what's the appropriate formalism to use if you're going to be an operationalist. So let me just start by reviewing a couple of things from last time. So we went over the textbook orthodox postulates of quantum theory, and we found that if you wanted to make them completely operational, then you should eliminate references to physical states of systems and try to make everything couched in terms of primitive concepts of experimental operations. And so this is what we're going to do today. Try to eliminate all these terms from the formalism and just talk about operations you can do in the laboratory. Now, so here was the basic scheme for doing that. You would associate vectors with preparation procedures, unitary maps with transformations, Hermitian operators with measurements, and this projection postulate with the effective preparation that comes from doing a measurement after a preparation. But it turns out that those elements of the formalism aren't sufficiently general to represent the most generic kind of preparation and the most generic kind of measurement. And so today we're going to talk about how to expand the formalism to be able to deal with those cases. So I'm going to start just by giving you some facts that maybe you've come across that should lead you to be suspicious that this formalism is sufficiently general. OK, so the first question is, how could you represent a preparation that corresponds to one element of a pair of entangled systems? So you have a pair of systems that are prepared in this quantum state, and you want to be able to predict the outcomes of measurements done on just one of them. Okay? And the question is there a vector in Hilbert space that would be adequate for calculating the probabilities that would occur for any measurement device on that one system? So if I've written down here the singlet state. And if you know the singlet state, then you know that you can, so these are eigenstates of spin along the n-axis. You know that you can rewrite this with respect to any axis at all. So if I change n to some other direction, it has exactly the same form. So what that means is if I come up to the first system with a spin along the n direction, and I measure it, well, I should get 50-50 statistics, because there's probability half for this term, probability half for that term, along plus or minus. But that's true for any direction that I choose to measure on that first spin. So that tells me that for every spin axis I can measure, I'll get 50-50 statistics. What's the vector in Hilbert space that gives you those statistics? There's none. All the pure states of a two-dimensional system will give you predictable statistics for at least one direction. So there's no vector that could describe the statistics for just one system. So you need something different. It's going to turn out it's a density operator. OK, another puzzle. How can you represent irreversible dynamics? So far, the only dynamics we have is unitary, and that's reversible. So for instance, if you cool a quantum system, you can have a map that takes it, no matter what its state is, takes it to its ground state. Well, that's clearly not a unitary map, because it takes many states to this one state, and unitary transformations are one-to-one. So you'll need something more general than unitaries, obviously, here. Now, those two aren't quite so surprising. The more surprising one, the less common element of the formalism, this general formalism, is the generalization of a Hermitian operator. So if you've done any quantum optics, for example, or perhaps this has come up in your field theory course, if you detect a photon at a certain position, then you update the quantum state by applying the field operator, the annihilation operator, at that position. But we saw in the postulates that the way you update after measurement is by applying a projector to your state and then normalizing. And it's easy to verify that the quantum field operator is not a projector. It's not even Hermitian. So how does that work? I mean, this doesn't seem to be consistent with the projection postulate. So you need a more general notion of measurement. Something that might be a bit less familiar is that if you're doing quantum optics, you start with that sort of update map, and you calculate things like, what's the probability in photodetection of finding k photons in my photodetector? Well, you can work it out. It's the normally ordered version of this operator here, where A is the annihilation operator for the mode that your photodetector detects. And what you end up getting is an operator that looks like this, which is essentially a noisy measurement of number. If there's n photons present, then your photodetector might reveal n photons, but it might reveal fewer with certain probabilities. And this thing is not a projector. So when I ask what's the probability of k photons, I don't take the expectation value of a projector. So clearly, projectors are not enough. So one final example. Suppose you have the following coupling between your system and a pointer. So the two systems over here are going to be pointers. The first system is your system of interest. Yes?
What do you mean by a pointer?
Oh, I just mean a system which is going to be a probe for your system of interest. Okay, so in so von Neumann in his textbook, for example, says, let's try to do a model of measurement. And he says, we're going to take this as our probe and this is our system. We're going to couple the probe to the system in such a way that depending on the eigenvalue of an operator A for the system, my probe will be shifted by a different amount. And then I will measure the position of my probe. And so that's what I'm doing here. These two final systems are probes. P is the momentum operator, which is the generator of translations. So this sort of interaction term in your Hamiltonian tells you to shift the probe by an amount that depends on the eigenvalue of A. So if you just had a term like this in your Hamiltonian, you would have a measurement that measured the operator A. And if you had a term like this, you'd have a measurement that revealed B, and it would show up in the second probe. And the question is, what happens if you have both? Well, if you have both those terms, then you're going to find that you have these two probes. One's responding to operator A, the other's responding to operator B. But A and B could be non-commuting operators. They could be position and momentum, for example. And so what you expect is that this thing will give you a bit of information about A and a bit of information about B, position and momentum, for instance, and that you'll have a joint measurement of the two. They won't be perfectly accurate, but there'll be noisy measurements of those two non-commuting operators. And that's right. That's essentially how it works out. And again, what you find is that there's no Hermitian operator that can describe such a measurement, a joint measurement of these two non-commuting quantities. Yes?
So, what are you doing there? A tensor, B tensor,
I? So here I'm describing a term, an interaction term in a Hamiltonian. So I'm saying, suppose you establish a coupling between your system of interest and a probe, and the coupling has that form.
What exactly is P?
So P is the momentum operator for the probe. So typically, if you wrote down such a coupling term, and then you calculated the evolution, what you'd find is that the probe, would its wave function would be shifted in position by an amount proportional to the eigenvalue of A. I'm not going to go into this in detail because these are meant to be motivating examples. So if the formalism here is not familiar to you, then it won't be motivational for you. But that's OK. You don't need to understand the details of these examples. I'll give you the whole formalism in due course. These examples are just meant to make you think. I'm hoping that perhaps you've come across one or two of these things, and and therefore you think, well, yeah, there's something mysterious there. You know, why is it that, for example, the prescription for updating the state in quantum optics is not consistent with the projection postulate. There's something fishy there. That's what I'm hoping.
Yes? The quantum optics example where the photon gets absorbed.
Yep.
The problem with that, does it have to do with the fact that the formalism that you presented so far doesn't take into account how particles, the number of particles changing system?
Well, the Hilbert spaces that you're describing in those postulates, there was no real constraint on them. So they could have been Fock spaces. I can still define projection operators on a Fock space. And the point is that that sort of update rule still won't be sufficiently general to describe that sort of thing. So other questions about the motivation? All right. In any case, regardless of whether those examples motivate you or not, I want to, in this lecture, tell you how we need to generalize our representation of preparations, measurements, and probably next time we'll talk about transformations. And so for that, I'm going to shift the blackboard to give you all the details. I'll just put this up for now. OK. So we'll start with more general sets of preparations. OK, so there are many ways of seeing that you need to have something beyond Hilbert space vectors. And I'm going to start with an example of ensembles or mixtures of pure states. Right, so what I'm imagining is you have a scenario where you have some preparation procedures that are associated with Hilbert space vectors psi 1, psi 2, and psi 3, for example. And then you have essentially what's a switch. So I'm imagining that you have some random number generator. I'll represent that as a die. It has some probability distribution pi associated with it. And it's going to generate random numbers between 1 and 3. And that's going to tell me which of these three systems to feed forward. Okay, so basically, this is going to be a device that either puts out a system in state psi 1 or in psi 2 or in psi 3. And the question is this. If I put this whole thing in a box and I say this is a new effective preparation procedure, how should I represent that procedure? And by that, I mean, how can I predict the outcomes of an arbitrary measurement that would follow that procedure? OK, so let's assume that this measurement is associated with an operator whose spectral projectors I'll just call pi k. The eigenvalues are not important because the probabilities of getting the different outcomes depend only on those projectors, not on the eigenvalues. OK, so now what I want to calculate is the probability for getting outcome k in that measurement, given that you did this. So that's not hard to calculate. You just have to use Bayes' rule. So you say it's just the probability that the ith preparation happened times the probability I'll get outcome k, given that I did the ith preparation, summed over I. Yes?
Should it bother us that we're talking about pure quantum states in an operational viewpoint?
In what sense? That it's an idealization, or?
Well, in the sense that if the operational viewpoint takes as an assumption that we shouldn't consider pure states to be real physical things.
Well, we shouldn't consider states to be real physical things.
Okay, yeah. What I will admit is that I'm perhaps being a bit loose in my language. So certainly, you wouldn't want to say something like, I prepare a system in this state. You'd want to say, I do a preparation procedure associated with a state. And then I align, you know, one of these three apertures with the output aperture of my black box. And I could say everything that way. And I would never be talking about systems. But the other part of your question, you're saying, is it appropriate that we associate a pure state with a preparation procedure at all? Yes. The claim I was making earlier was just that it's not the most general type of mathematical formalism. So there will be preparation procedures associated with pure states, and there will be others for which there's no pure state that's appropriate.
Oh.
Okay. So these are preparations for which it is appropriate to associate a pure state with them. This is one for which it's not.
Model of the die dropping machine, like everything inside that box.
Yep.
Would then the state coming out be a pure state?
No. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Okay. So so now I know what the probability of getting outcome k is given one of these. It's just the expectation value for psi I of the projector pi k. Because that's what, if I just put one of these in front of him, that would be the probability of outcome k. We saw that last time. So that's the answer. And now we just rearrange that into a more elegant form. So are you familiar with this equation, that the expectation value for an operator A is the same as the trace of that operator times the outer product of the state with itself. Is that familiar? If it's not familiar with you, let me know. It's not embarrassing. It just means I'll do the calculation. Okay. So the definition of the trace is just I take a complete basis for the Hilbert space, and I sandwich everything inside the trace with an expectation value for that basis. I sum over the basis elements. And now this is a scalar. That's a scalar. And so I can change the order of those things because they're not operators anymore. And then I get psi k, k, a psi summed over k. But this guy here, if I sum up these outer products, is just identity. So that's psi a psi, which is what we're trying to prove. OK, so I use that here. And what I get is trace of pi k outer product psi I with itself times pi. And then because the trace is linear, I can take the sum to the inside. And I get trace of pi k sum over I pi outer product of psi I with itself. And this I will call rho.
Oops.
Hang on a second. So the point is that I can calculate this probability of an outcome by taking the trace of pi k, the projector associated with this measurement, and some operator now which represents this whole box. So this operator is called a density operator. It has this form. Let's take a look at its properties. So the first thing is that it's a positive definite operator. Sometimes I'll just say positive. Yes?
Positive semi-definite.
What's the definition of positive semi-definite?
Okay, I always know the definition semi-definite means positive or zero for eigenvalues.
Right. So this one is, so that's the definition of positive semi-definite.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this one is not going to be zero. It's going to have trace one. OK, so it's going to be a non-zero operator. So the, yes? No, you can have zero eigenvalues, but they can't all be zero.
Yeah, this must just be a different.
So that's semi-definite, right?
Is that the definition of semi-definite?
Yeah, it could be semi-definite.
Yeah, if there's some
eigenvalues. Because there's zero eigenvalues, then it's
so what is it? Does anyone know the difference between definite and semi-definite?
Definite, they're all the eigenvalues are positive.
I see.
Semi-definite.
Okay, thanks. So this is should be semi-definite. So this is going to be greater than zero for all psi. The quality only if psi is equal to zero. Okay, so the proof that the rho that I derived down here does have that form is that if I take the expectation value for an arbitrary state psi on that, what I see is that I have the mod squared of this inner product. This is necessarily positive. These are necessarily positive. The only way to make this zero is if psi is zero. Therefore, this thing is positive semi-definite. The other property is that it has unit trace. So the proof of that is that if I take the trace of these guys, right, that's the expression for rho, And then we use the trick that we derived earlier. This just becomes something of this form. You can think of this as multiplying the identity. So I just have the expectation value of identity, but those are overlap 1. This is a probability distribution, so they sum to 1. Yes?
The statement up there that the equality is only if psi equals 0, it seems like if you can get 0 in other ways too. For example, let's say if I is 1, 2, and 3, and P1, 2, and 3 are positive, but P4 is 0, and then psi was equal to psi 4. So then it wouldn't project
right
onto psi 1, 2, and 3, and then, but it would project onto psi 4 and be multiplied by 0. Maybe all the PIs have to be non-zero, and then so if it was positive definite, not semi-definite, then it would be. And I guess that makes sense. I mean, there's no point in including a state with zero probability in your density matrix, right?
Yep.
So
yeah, that's right.
Maybe six positive definite. What else?
Yes?
Just to some kind of very special, the way PI are generated is random, so each of them have equal probability of being hit, so there's no reason to check the table of zero probability.
Well, here I'm assuming a probability distribution that's arbitrary. So it doesn't have to be a uniform distribution. So I could have the, you know, P1, P2, and P3 being non-equal.
Oh, yes, that's right.
So yeah, the resolution of your question about positivity. It's a good point. So this thing has to be greater than 0 for all psi. But there can be psi for which it's equal to 0. You know, any psi that's orthogonal to the support of rho will give you a 0 expectation. There obviously has to exist some psi for which it's positive. I'm unclear on the definition.
Can we just drop the last thing with the equality only if psi is equal to 0?
Yeah, I think you're right. But if I demand this together with unit trace, then I'm fine.
Well, we absolutely we have to drop that left, right? Because otherwise we can't have pure states.
Yeah. And there'll be mixed states as well because supports aren't the full space. Okay, I apologize for that. In any case, so these are the properties of a density operator. And now there are two special cases. So if you just have the outer product of some state with itself, then I'll call that a pure preparation. And if it's some non-trivial sum, so the PIs are not going to be 1 and all zeros, then this is called a mixed preparation. This is an important distinction when you start talking about taking mixtures of different procedures. These sorts of preparations cannot be obtained as non-trivial mixtures of a set of other preparations, whereas these can. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that. One other thing to note is that when we were dealing with vectors, we had this phase degree of freedom. So there was this unphysical global phase factor on the vectors. But if you're going to represent things in terms of density operators, you can still talk about the preparations which are associated with the vector, but now they're associated with the outer product of the vector with itself. And that doesn't have an overall phase factor. And so this freedom of representation you had that was unphysical is gone when you deal with density operators. So this is, I think this is a very nice feature. It's a bit more mathematically elegant to say that the the freedom that I have in specifying my mathematical quantity is the same as the freedom I have in preparation procedures. I don't have this extra freedom. And so if you want, you can represent even pure preparations in terms of these density operators. Okay, there's one other important example where you need this density operator concept, and that's the case where you have a bipartite system and you ignore part of that system. So imagine you've got now a preparation procedure, and I'll just draw it as having two output ports. So that means that you can bring a measurement device up to each one of these output ports, and you can get interesting results. And imagine I just put a brick in front of one of them, and I put this whole thing in a box, a black box, and I want to know what sorts of statistics will I get on measurements that follow this sort of preparation procedure. Given that the state I used, the vector I used to describe this guy was psi SA. So I'm labeling these two systems S and A. And there's going to be some bipartite vector that represents that preparation procedure. And I want to know, what should I use to make predictions about the outcomes of measurements over here? And I'm going to assume, again, that my measurement is associated with a set of projectors pi k. OK, so we do the same thing. We just use the quantum mechanics we know to calculate this. So the probability of getting outcome k in this measurement is just going to be the trace over the full Hilbert space, which is now the Hilbert space for both systems. So you know, maybe I should write that out explicitly. This psi is a member of the Hilbert space for S tensor the Hilbert space for A. So it's going to be the trace of that state psi with now the measurement projector pi on system S and identity on system A. Because system A, you can think of this as a measurement. It's just a trivial measurement. It only has one outcome. If I did a measurement and then I ignored which outcome I got, the operator, the projector I associate that is identity. You know, what's the probability that you got some outcome? It's always one. So the thing that I associate with it is the identity operator. And so here I'm just ignoring this system. It's equivalent to doing a measurement ignoring the outcome. So it's associated with the identity operator. So this is your probability of getting outcome k. Now, you can divide a trace over two systems into a product of traces over each. Because the trace over two systems is, I choose a basis for system S and a basis for system A. Label them by J and K. I have everything here, JS, KA. And now I can take the sum over K, and I can move it through this projector, because this is defined on the Hilbert space for system S. So I can rewrite this as just the trace on system S of pi k s times the trace over system A of this. This creature here is now it's a state in the Hilbert space SA traced over A. So if I took the trace of just something on A, I would get a scalar. But taking the trace over A on something that's defined on this larger Hilbert space leaves me an operator on S. So I have an operator on S, a projector on S, and I'm tracing over S. So this whole thing will be a probability. So this operator here is called, I'll call it rho S. It's called the reduced density operator. Of psi SA on S. And it has this, so that equation has the same form as this equation here. And it tells me that this is the operator I should associate with that whole preparation procedure. So I think that maybe in the tutorial you'll be seeing more of the partial trace. So this is unclear. Hopefully it'll be clear when you do this problem in the tutorial. So let's do an example of this. Where should I do it? Over here. So let me start with a two-dimensional, say, a pair of systems. Each is a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And the quantum state will just be 0s, 0a, plus 1s, 1a, like so. So I want to know, what's the reduced density operator on s? So I just take the trace over a of this, the outer product of psi sa with itself. So this is the trace over A of the following. Right? Yes.
Earlier you had said that we needed psi SA to be bifurcated.
Yes.
But in this case it seems like it isn't because we've got an equal state.
Ah, so that when I said it should be a bipartite system, what I meant by that was the state should be in the tensor product of these two Hilbert spaces.
Okay. And I misunderstood the word.
Right. So the term that would be appropriate for what you're thinking is product state. If I said psi SA is a product state, then I'd be saying it's of the form of some state in S tensor some state in A. Like that. Okay, so this is, I've just taken psi SA, its outer product with itself, I get this. And now I take the trace over A. So, you know, remember that the trace of some outer product is just, or chi phi, is just the inner product between phi and chi. So if I acted on this term, I get 1. If I acted on this term, I get the inner product of 0 and 1, which is 0, so it goes away. On this term, I get 0. This term, I get 1. So it's just this, which is 1/2 times the identity operator on S. So the reduced density operator for this maximally entangled state, turns out you can't have any more entanglement than this guy, is just the completely mixed state. And then if you start asking, well, if I do a measurement on system S, so suppose that psi SA were this state I wrote down, and I start doing measurements here. So I could measure spin along any axis I like on this two-dimensional system. In every case, I would get 50-50 statistics, because if I put in rho s, so say my measurement is, so suppose I'm measuring along some basis, which I'll label plus and minus n. Okay, you can think of these as directions for the spin or directions in the Bloch sphere, which we'll talk about in a moment. Then you know the probability of getting either the up or down result is going to just be trace of this reduced density operator times this guy. But this is just a half identity. That's always just going to give me 1. So no matter what I measure, I'll get 50-50 statistics. And that's like what the example I showed you earlier for the singlet state, where no matter what you measured on 1/2, you just got a random outcome. Yes?
Is there some kind of example of this, like a stir or something like that?
You're looking for an example of how you would prepare such a state?
Yeah, or just, I don't know, something concrete about this, the what's happening, or what's 1/2 identity as really means?
what does it really mean? Well, you can think of it in an entirely operational way. It's the thing that completely specifies, it'll tell you how to generate the statistics for any measurement that you do on S. So it's the only object. Once I tell you, you know, I've got a black box with this inside of it, you can actually forget all about the contents and just write down a half identity and say, right, this box is associated with half identity. There's many boxes that have other things inside them that are associated with half identity, but they all give exactly the same statistics for all measurements. So that's all you need to know about it. Is there another way to think about it? Let me talk about the block sphere representation, and then other ways of thinking about it will become clear. As to the other part of your question, you know, how can I prepare this sort of state experimentally? In quantum optics labs, they prepare entangled states of the polarization of two photons very easily using parametric down conversion, for example. So, and they're quite good at it now. So these are relatively exotic processes that generate these sorts of states. But these days, experimentally, it's, I guess you could say, a bit mundane. People do it all over, all the time now. The reason I chose S and A here was because at various points, we'll be talking about this other system as an ancilla system. Okay, so I would say this is system and this is ancilla. Ancilla, I think, is Greek for handmade. And so somebody at some point introduced this ancilla because in quantum information theory, it tends to be something that you introduce to help you do something. So that's the origin. OK, I'm going to talk about the block sphere representation. So did you cover this in tutorial a bit already?
Just introduced it.
OK, so you've already seen that one can associate for two-dimensional Hilbert space. You can associate every pure state with a point on the surface of a sphere. And the mixed states, which are the ones that are sums of outer products of states, are associated with the points on the inside of the sphere. Let me just label some of these points. So this would be the zero state. So there's some. This is just a conventional choice, some fixed basis. And then there'll be the states plus and minus, which are defined as just 0 plus or minus 1 over root 2. Now, I want to tell you exactly, you know, why this association works. And the way I'm going to do it is by convincing you that the Hermitian operators actually form a vector space of their own. So if you look at the Hermitian operators on a vector space of dimension D, so on Hilbert space, what you find is that they form a real Hilbert space. So the original Hilbert space was complex. But the Hermitian operators form a real Hilbert space of dimension d squared. Why is that? Well, suppose you have some pair of operators. So suppose A and B are Hermitian. Well, then any scalar multiple of A with some R, which is part of the reals, is also a Hermitian operator. So it's closed under multiplication by real scalars. And furthermore, if I take any sum of Hermitian operators, it's still Hermitian. Right, if I take the dagger of this, I'll just have A dagger plus B dagger, which is A plus B. So the Hermitian operators are closed under linear combinations over the reals. Therefore, they form a vector space over the reals. You can also introduce an inner product, which I'll denote A comma B, as just the trace of the product of A and B. OK, so now let's prove that it has all the properties of an inner product on a real vector space. It's linear in both arguments. Right, if I multiply b by a scalar, I can just pull that out of the trace. If you wanted to define a, if you look at all the linear operators on Hilbert space, you can find that they form a complex Hilbert space of dimension b squared. And for that case, you would want to use trace a dagger b as an inner product. But here, I'm only interested in the Hermitian operators. Makes life just a little bit easier. So it's linear in the second argument. It's linear in the first argument as well. It's symmetric. That follows from the cyclic property of the trace, which you may be seeing in tutorial or have seen. I can always move B over here. And then finally, it's always non-negative, no matter what. Let's see. Because if I put A and A in, I get A squared. All the eigenvalues of A squared will be positive, even if A has some negative eigenvalues. So it's an inner product. So I can call it a Hilbert space. You know, really, because we're in finite dimensions in this course, a Hilbert space is just an inner product space. There's no difference. You know, technically, you know, in infinite dimensions, there's extra conditions that a Hilbert space has to satisfy. Here, those don't apply. Okay, so we know that the Hermitian operators form a real Hilbert space. And so what it means is that you can decompose any Hermitian operator in terms of a basis of that Hilbert space. And it turns out that an orthogonal basis for the set of operators on a two-dimensional space is given by the Pauli operators. So these are, I'll just write them out in their matrix form. I'm considering the identity operator to be one of the Paulis. And I'm numbering the others 0 through 3. OK, so I can write any Hermitian operator I like as some sum of these Pauli operators. And then we just choose. OK, then if I ask, well, what if this Hermitian operator is a density operator? That means it's positive. It means it has trace 1. Those are the properties we established earlier. And in tutorial, you'll show, I believe, that in that case, you get constraints on those coefficients such that you can write it in the following form. So the coefficient for identity will just be a half. And the coefficients on the three Pauli operators are constrained. Here I'm just writing it as the sigma vector is the vector consisting of sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. So R is a 3 vector. And what you can show is that positivity and the trace 1 condition imply that the magnitude of this vector has to be less than 1. So that is, this R vector are the vectors in the Bloch sphere. If R is equal to 1, then you can show that this density operator is just the outer product of some vector with itself. It's one of the pure states. And if it's less than 1, then it's mixed and it lies on the inside. If it's equal to 0, then it's just a half identity, which is the point at the center, the 0 R vector. So is that clear?
If R is less than 1, it's a mixed.
That's right. Maximally mixed. Did I say maximally entangled? I meant to say maximally mixed. Yeah, so we have just one system, so there's no entanglement.
And on the surface, you said it's pure?
Yes, that's right.
Why?
Why is it that on the surface it's pure? Well, one of the conditions for purity would be that trace rho squared is equal to 1, for example. Was that in the tutorial yesterday, or is that today?
It was, but I'll do rehash it.
You'll rehash it today. So if you take the trace rho squared equal to 1 condition and put this form in, you'll see that that corresponds to the magnitude of R being 1. So I guess for now, you'll have to just trust me on various properties. Yep.
So the guys you just erased, they
yes.
had rho was 1.
Yes.
Wasn't that a state?
So that was a state of two-dimensional systems.
Right.
And its state lies in a bigger space, which has 15 parameters. And then if I take a reduced density operator, I would find that half of the state was represented by this S. Yeah. OK, so one other property that is of interest. So if I take just the trace of two density operators, rho and rho prime, and I write out the form for each, r dot sigma, so I'll associate vector r with rho, vector s with rho prime. If you work this out and you make use of the fact that the trace of any one of these sigma x, sigma y, or sigma z poly operators is 0, you find that it's just a half 1 plus r dot s. And so in particular, if rho and rho prime are orthogonal states, that means that the product of their density operators is 0, right? If I just take the outer product onto psi with the outer product onto something perpendicular to psi, I'll get 0. And similarly for any other mixed states whose supports are orthogonal. In higher dimensions, there are some. But here, it's just pure states. So if this is 0, then that means that R has to be minus S. And so that tells me that orthogonal states are represented by antipodal points on the Bloch sphere. So 0, 1, plus, minus, and so on. OK. How long have I been going now?
I think we started about 20 past, so you have maybe
2 minutes?
5.
Okay. Okay. Let me just tell you about the ambiguity of mixtures, and then I'll stop. I'll do it here. So the very first case we looked at where we needed a density operator was where I had I rolled the dice and I decided which pure state to prepare. Well, it turns out that there's different procedures of that form that all give rise to the same density operator. So in particular, if I roll or I say flip a coin, that's fair. So it has 50-50 statistics. And I prepare, if I implement a preparation procedure associated with the state 0, if I get heads, I implement a preparation procedure associated with the state 1, if I get tails, then the density operator associated with that mixture is just a half outer product of 0 plus a half outer product of 1. It turns out that I get the same density operator if I prepare plus or minus after my coin flip. And the way to see this is you can just use the definition of plus or minus, plus n minus. So this is 0 plus 1. This guy is 0 minus 1. You get two cross terms here, which cancel with the two cross terms here, and you're left with this. So you have these two different ways of writing it down. But in fact, there are many more than this. So we're talking about the complete mixed state. So any line through this will give me two states. So actually, any two orthogonal states mixed with equal weights will give me the complete mixed state. But there are more. There are even more mixtures that will give me that. So let me give you another example involving two non-orthogonal states. So here, I'm going to move away. I'm going to give an example that doesn't involve a complete mixed state. So my density operator is 3 quarters 0 plus 1 quarter 1. And it turns out that that's equivalent to an equal mixture of states A and B, where A is root 3 quarters 0 plus root 1 quarter 1, and B is the same thing but with the opposite phase. And if you plug those in, follow the same logic, you'll see that it's equivalent to the first state. So in the block sphere, what this looks like is if, you know, this is the zero state and this is the one state. This density operator corresponds to the point that's 3/4 of the way up from 1 to 0. This decomposition is the decomposition to these two states, and this one is the decomposition into these two states. And it turns out that any line you draw through this will give you a decomposition, and the relative length of those things will give you the relative weights in which the pure states appear in that decomposition. So let me just prove that fact to you, and then I'll stop. Let me do it over here. So what I'm interested in are decompositions of an arbitrary density operator into a sum of density operators. So I'll call the density operators in the sum rho k. And so I'm interested in all the ways in which one can be decomposed into others. These might be pure, they might not. Well, let's write this out in terms of the block sphere representation. So I'll associate r with rho. Oh, and I should mention that this number of terms isn't necessarily 2. It could be 3, 4, any number. I'll call this rk dot sigma. So if you look at this equation and you equate terms associated with the same operator, what you find is that r has to be a convex combination of the rks, like so. OK, so let's consider the case where we just have 2 elements in this sum. So then I would have something like r is p times r1 plus 1 minus p times r2, because these have to sum to identity. I can write that as r2 plus p times r1 minus r2. So in the block sphere, if I find r2, right, so that's the point associated with rho 2, and I then move along, so let's say r1 is over here. Okay, that's the point associated with rho 1. Then I can calculate r1 minus r2. That's a vector that basically takes me from r2 to r1. And I move some distance p along it, and that will give me rho. So as I vary p from 0 to 1, these are all the possible ways of combining these two states. I just get a state somewhere on the line between them. So what it tells us is mixtures of density operators correspond to the line between the two density operators that I'm mixing. And if I move to 3 density operators, you can use a similar, so let's say I have 3 operators on the block sphere, so 3 block vectors associated with them. Then it turns out that the density operators I can get by mixing them fall in the triangle that's spanned. And if I take 4, I get all the density operators in the tetrahedron. So the density operators appearing here will form a polytope in the block sphere, and everything inside that polytope I can access by taking mixtures of them. And so now you see that, you know, the mixed state here, in addition to all these lines through it, I can decompose it into 3 states, for example, along a triangle that contains the center of the block sphere. Maybe it's better to draw it on a plane. So if I have a completely mixed state, I can take an equal mixture of 3 states on a triangle and also get the completely mixed state. Or I could take more points. For a state that's not at the center of the block sphere, so maybe one over here, I can take lines through it, but I can also take lines that go like this. This is a decomposition to non-orthogonal states. I can take any line I like. I can also take 3 points that contain it, and so on. So I have all these possibilities for convex decompositions of density operator. And so coming back to the earlier question, you know, how should I think of identity over 2? Well, there are many ways of thinking of it. You can think of it as an equal mixture of these two states. You can think of it as equal mixture of these two states. You can think of it as an equal mixture of these three states. You can think of it also as half, you know, one system that's part of a maximally entangled pair of states. So there's all these different situations where in the complete mixed state is the right object to use to predict what's going to happen in measurements. But they all correspond to different preparation procedures. And that is a very significant fact about quantum mechanics. And I'll tell you why it's very significant, why it sort of contains the nugget, or it's part of what distinguishes quantum theory from other ways the world might have been. From an operationalist perspective, this ambiguity of mixtures is really critical. So we'll get to that next time.